come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be the poet Heather Hartley. She is author of Knock Knock, which is a fantastic collection of poems put out by Carnegie Mellon University Press. And she is also a visiting writer at the University of Texas, El Paso, yes, UTEP, us, in the online MFA. She teaches poetry with us, and she lives in Paris, and she's just a fantastic poet. I can't wait to talk to her. She's also going to read a poem from her new collection, and so that's kind of exciting. One of the things that I'm going to ask her, I read somewhere in an interview that one of her influences is Dr. Seuss. Yes, Dr. Seuss. She is a very serious, again, sometimes not so serious poet, and so I'm really kind of interested how Dr. Seuss has influenced her, because I have a confession to make. Dr. Seuss is one of my early influences. First of all, I think in fiction, I'm a fiction writer, I think in fiction, one of the most important aesthetic phenomenons is that moment when you're reading and you forget you're reading and you're so absorbed in that world. It's like a movie playing in your head, or even better, it's like virtual reality, like you're entering into this other universe and you look around and everything seems so real. Dr. Seuss did that to me when I was 7 years old. I remember reading Star-Bellied Sneetches, which was one of my favorite books ever, even today. And that's the book about prejudice, where the Sneetches are these really kind of like bird-looking, weird-looking creatures, and those who have stars in their bellies are the superior ones. And those who don't have stars in their bellies are, of course, as a kid, I was thinking, they're the Mexicans. They're like us. They don't have stars on their bellies, and everyone's prejudiced against them. And it was a fantastic experience as a child. But one of the things I love about Dr. Seuss is the language, and how he is able to, even at an early age, when we're little kids, we're learning how to break rules when it comes to language. And I have a quote here from one of my other favorite stories, The Grinch That Stole Christmas. But listen to the language, because this is really cool. The quote is like this. For tomorrow, he knew, all the Who girls and boys would wake bright and early, they'd rush for their toys. And then, oh, the noise, 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 noise. That's one thing he hated, the noise, 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 noise. Then the Who's, young and old, would sit down to a feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, feast, feast. Doesn't that language remind you a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe? When you think of the bells, 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 and it continues to do that. And if you think about Dr. Seuss, and if you look at something like this story, or you look at perhaps the Star-Bellied Sneetches, or the Cat in the Hat, or what was that one that we loved, Green Eggs and Ham, and you look at the rhythms, a lot of it sounds a little bit like Poe. And there is a darkness to it as well. And there is this willingness to break the rules of language, and that we're exposed to that as kids. And I think if I were to ask a lot of poets, maybe 10 poets, I don't know if it'd be statistically significant, but I should ask 10 poets. I'm going to do that. The next 10 poets on the show, I'm going to ask, did you read Dr. Seuss as a kid? And perhaps reading Dr. Seuss is one of the things that causes us to bend language, to bend sentences in unique ways, and to play with words. So I'm going to ask Heather Hartley about her Dr. Seuss's influence on her work. Heather Hartley, like I said, teaches with us here at UTEP in the online MFA. She lives in Paris, but it's an online MFA. So if you teach with us, you can live anywhere in the world. If you're a student, you can be scattered around the world, which our students are. Next year, we're going to do a low residency in Paris. We did one this year in London and Madrid. Next year, we're doing one in Paris. This is where our online MFA students meet, and we workshop, and we go to plays, and we go to literary events. Anyway, stick around. We're going to talk to Heather Hartley. This is Daniel Chacon for Words on a Wire. Heather Hartley is the author of Knock Knock, a collection of poems we're going to talk about today, and the forthcoming collection, Adult Swim, both from Carnegie Mellon University Press. She is Paris editor for the Tin House magazine. Her poems and essays and other works have appeared in Tin House, Mississippi Review, Post Road, many others. And she lives in Paris, where she co-directs the Shakespeare and Company Literary Festival. She is also a visiting writer in the online MFA right here at UTEP. And we're very happy to have her on the show. Heather, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel. I'm happy to be speaking with you. It's fabulous.
And I'm happy to have just read your book, Knock Knock, a book of poems by Carnegie Mellon Press. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much. It was a delight to have it come out, and thanks so much for reading. I hope you enjoyed.
Yeah, and you know, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but think that this book would have never happened hadn't you moved to Paris.
That's one of the themes in the book is, in fact, about travel, I think. And, I mean, in some ways, poetry is often about travel, right? In a lot of different ways, whether it's on the page or through voice or through sound. And that's right. This first book, a lot of it is based kind of on outward cities and landscapes, including Paris, where I've been for over a decade now. Also, Naples in Italy and then St. Petersburg. And also there's some of Charleston, West Virginia, my hometown in there. And I think that that book is in part about travel and what happens to language or languages when you travel.
And you know, you were mentioning travel not necessarily as a faraway place, but travel just, it's almost an ability. I think that if one can learn to travel at home, for example, then one can be just as aware as when one enters into new lands and sees new things. And, but it is almost like a skill to learn how to travel, to learn to travel at home, to learn to travel no matter where you're at.
I agree. I think that part of that is wherever you're traveling, if it's just to your desk and back, which is obviously absolutely important as a writer, the thing to do,
right,
that idea of travel can really be incorporated into your work. And one of the outward ways is to hop on a bus or a plane or run somewhere, run towards something. But also, it can be just letting yourself see and discover on the page what language can do. And language is all around on so many levels, wherever you are.
Yeah.
And foreign language, or the idea of maybe languages we don't know as well as our mother tongues, is more and more a part of what's happening, I think, wherever you are in the world. And it's important to be attentive, or it's a good thing to be attentive. I think we have better ears for music than we often give ourselves credit.
I'm sure you would agree that I don't think a poet needs to go to Paris to write good poems. It doesn't hurt, that's for dang sure. But it's certainly not necessary. I think of Kafka and his journals, and he writes something about you don't have to leave your kitchen, that if you just stay there and focus, that the universe is going to reveal itself to you.
Exactly. There's a poem that I return to a lot, Elizabeth Bishop's Questions of Travel. And that is really one of her mainstays or themes in this poem is, and I'll just paraphrase, is that it's just wherever you end up, the choice is never wide and never free. And should you have stayed at home, wherever that could possibly be, and that's a paraphrase.
Yeah.
But that's the idea. Where is home? And where do we write when we're coming from home or going elsewhere? And certainly one doesn't have to be in Paris at all to write. That's the beauty of writing, is that with a notebook and pen, you can be in the desert, you can be in your coffee shop, in your mom's basement, or you can be on top of the Arc de Triomphe.
Yes.
Anywhere.
Yes, you could be in Fresno, California. You could be in Battle Creek, Michigan. I don't know why I came up with Battle Creek, Michigan, but you could be there. But you're not, Heather Hartley. You are in Paris. And in many ways, you are living the writer's dream. My God, what motivated a young woman? I imagine you were a very young woman when you went there, because I met you recently in Seattle. And quite frankly, you're young now. So here's a very young woman going to Paris. And what made you decide you're going to stay there? And give us that narrative. I mean, it's fascinating. I'm sure it's the dream of many writers. I know for the last, since the first time I went to Paris, I thought, you know what? I'm going to live here someday. And I haven't done it yet. You did it. How?
Part of it is, I think, determination, just like with writing or with anything that we do, with teaching, with learning how to ride a bike, all of that, learning how to make a good omelet, good cup of coffee. It's about determination and wanting to and compromise at some point. When I was 19, I'd always wanted to try and read Baudelaire, Charles Baudelaire in the original. Now, that is a big, big statement. And so when I got to his poem and I saw it in French, I thought, wow, this is, I don't know how I'm ever going to get to read this poem, but I was fascinated by the idea, kind of the puzzle that it represented on the page, his work in French. And I didn't speak any other language then. But French had always kind of fascinated me. Just it seemed kind of strong and resonant and exotic in some ways, having grown up just speaking and thinking in English and everything like that. I didn't have a lot of exposure to a lot of foreign language. And so I thought, okay, well, let's take a look at this. So the fascination started with Charles Baudelaire and then pretty much veered towards the more important things like how to order that cup of coffee or you know how to make a reservation. So I had to really dial back on my idea of what I could do in the language pretty much right away. But I thought, you know, okay, let's save up a little money. Let's get an undergraduate degree and see what we can do afterwards. I really wanted to see about the possibility of living in a foreign language. And, you know, at that point, having been younger, it was a lot easier to kind of jump on a plane. It was my first job after university was as an English teaching assistant in Nantes on the west coast.
Oh, wow.
So at that point, I really came into contact with the fact that I wasn't ready to read Baudelaire. I had a lot of work to do. And so I started getting fascinated kind of on a different level with the language. And then throughout the years, there was some coming back to the States, and I applied for a graduate program with Middlebury for a master's and studied there. And then one thing leads to another, and boom, 10 years later, you're here. It's really a question of working on it and compromise and learning how to live not just in a foreign language, but with it kind of every day, which is exciting and amazing and also challenging sometimes.
You're talking about determination. You're talking about the will to do something. And I just got back from Oviedo, Spain, where I attended a conference and I did a reading from Hotel Juarez, and I met a professor there from Catalan, from Barcelona. And we were having really this wonderful conversation. We became friends very quickly. We were having this wonderful conversation about, you know, I tend to have a very upbeat attitude, and it's very obvious. People, you know, what are you doing? And I do anything I want. I mean, I travel a lot, and I have a very unconventional life. And I was just telling her about, you know, that determination. You just do it. You know, you create it. You do it, and you go for it. And she says, you sound very American. And it never occurred to me that that positive attitude, that Norman Vincent Peale attitude, is a uniquely American thing. Do you find that that's the case, that when you are positive, people, like, identify you as American as opposed to, like, maybe a more pessimistic European?
That has happened. I think sometimes it's an outward enthusiasm that we have, or that's part of our makeup in a lot of way, being American or having lived in America for a long time as well. I think both of those things do come out, and there's sometimes an effusive quality or something happening that it's a little different, it seems, in Europe from, or at least in France, from what I've lived and experienced over the years, that there can be a determination. It just might be a quieter determination.
Right.
But this idea of being positive and showing that on the outside is something that it doesn't happen every day here, but when it does and people are communicative about it and want it to happen, then they're really open to it. It's two different approaches kind of to looking at things. That's something that also you get a bit used to over the years. It takes a little bit of time. But I think it's much appreciated also in the writing, in the literature of American literature. It has a different kind of feel, of course, than French literature. There's a different way of speaking sometimes. You know, you work a lot in a foreign language. You speak a foreign language, so I know that foreign languages or different languages appeal to you in a different way. And it's some things might come to you in Spanish or Russian or any language, rather than just in English. So I think that's something to take into consideration as well and how it works in the literature.
Right, right. And so. I think ultimately people who are driven and determined are going to arrive at the same place, just perhaps, like you suggest, just in a different language, I guess you can say. And the extreme version of this, you can do anything you like, of course, comes out, strongly out of the United States and things like The Power of Intention and The Secret and all these, these books about, how you can create your own reality and stuff. But really, it's just, being driven by something, and you are clearly driven by language. And I want to first kind of touch on how learning a foreign language, how that caused you perhaps to understand English better and to be able to understand nuances and subtleties of the language. Did learning these other languages bring a complexity to your own?
It did. I'm working on Italian. I'm a slow learner, but I love the sound, and it did bring a complexity. At first, living here, and you see this in the first collection, Knock Knock, will be a little different in my second collection, Adult Swim, that's coming out a bit later. But it's this idea of having language kind of infused in your thoughts. So in Knock Knock, sometimes there'll be foreign expressions or foreign words kind of tossed in there, not necessarily with a lot of context, right, but right. Just on the page. And I think that in part is just how it is to walk down the street, and that's what you hear sometimes. You hear all of these different sounds of language and noise, and in some ways it's very layered. It reminds me somewhat of Guillaume Apollinaire, and that as a wonderful early 20th century poet who wrote Zone and who was really working in language in a way that was kind of modern and fabulous and subtle, and then not at all. And I think when you're learning a foreign language, particularly as you're not bilingual, you don't learn it as a child, then it really comes from the outside in. And once you live in a country, then the language comes from the inside out, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Knock Knock. It's a fantastic book. You know what's really interesting about this book is that the poems are so different from each other. I mean, you start with that opening poem, which is really wonderful. This is a fugue for the lost art of aching, which is really a beautiful poem. But then you get a poem like The Madonnas of Monte Pertuso, which is one of my favorite poems. It's very funny and very, very vivid. But, I mean, the diversity of these poems is just amazing. You have some prose poems, and you have some poems with one lines, one section, one line, one section, one line. How did this book come about, and how did the poems just become so seemingly disparate, but yet there's a unity in the collection?
I am a person who loves to take notes and keep journals and just scribble everything, like so many writers, like all writers. And so a lot of those poems come from that idea of those notes and putting those notes together in different ways. Or not exactly sound poetry, but not unlike sound poetry in some ways, where you grab something from over here, something from a billboard, something from your favorite writer, something from a recipe, and you put them all together and find that puzzle. Once again, I go back to that idea because I think it's really important in language and sound, and it's fascinating, and the idea of setting. So for me, the important thing, or the central thing I was trying to do with my first book, was tell a story. Let the story or stories be told as they needed to be told. So sometimes that would be in one line, a sparse idea on the page, otherwise a prose poem or something dense, but just to take risks. And that's what I like to tell students. That's what I told my MFA online students. Take some risks on the page. Take the risk. That's really where the good writing comes from, is I think taking risks, not just taking risks, but that energy and vivacity and veracity on the page will be there if you're willing to take that risk. Travel in that way.
I'm really interested in process and how a poet goes from the impulse to the final draft. Do you follow language? Do you follow image? You mentioned earlier it's story. Is that what it is? You follow story? And how do you follow that story? Do you follow it with language? Do you follow it with image? Do you follow it with... I'd love to hear about your process in a poem, like, for example, the last poem about the young women who kill themselves, the sisters who kill themselves. It's just a lovely, lovely poem. How do you go about from the impulse to the product?
For Elegy in India Ink, for example, the last poem in Knock Knock, I read an article that appeared in the New York Times, and it was in part image, what you're asking there about what do I follow in terms of story. It was in part the images that were included in the article, and then, of course, the article itself, and just a few lines from that article, probably because I'm detail-oriented in some ways and then not in others. I couldn't remember the entire article when I went back to take notes on it away from the piece, just with my notebook in hand and everything. And what did come to mind was just the image of the sisters and this terrible fate that they choose for themselves. And so that poem, in terms of the story, I thought, how am I going to tell this story? What's the best way, or is there a good way to tell this? And so from that came a lot of notes and images and some sections that weren't included. For me, revising is very important. And probably the first things that do come to mind are images, that image that appeared in the article. And from there comes the idea for language. So for me, when from the impulse to the final draft or the final round, because I do love to kind of go back and redo things sometimes, I would say that it would be really image that is driving. And for me, the story, there's so many different ways to try and tell a story. And I think part of it can be through the images that are created or through a specific setting in a poem. And some of the beauty, I think, of the beautiful things of writing a poem is that in one or two pages, you have an entire world.
Yeah.
You know, you have an entire life. You can do the same absolutely in prose. You can do it in 300 words or less or more. And in poetry, though, you also have this idea of the page that's very often a part of it, or the idea of a form like a sonnet or a villanelle. So you have these different structures that are created, and within it you create the story. Once again, that idea of puzzle or pattern, I think, is something that I go back to a lot.
Well, all I know is I think one of the best things we ever did here at UTEP in the online MFA Creative Writing is to ask you to teach a poetry seminar. The students loved it, and we certainly hope that you can teach with us again. We're running out of time, but I have one question that I have to ask before we go. I read somewhere, I recall, it's been a while, but I could have swore I read somewhere in an interview that one of your first influences was Dr. Seuss. Is that true?
Yes. Dr. Seuss is a writer that whom I return to a lot. I think that his language is so vibrant and funny and whimsical, and humor is really important in poetry. And when I taught UTEP with the MFA online, it was wonderful because we were able to talk about humor, and we had an entire week where we just dedicated ourselves to humor in poetry. And part of that comes from my fascination since I was a kid with Dr. Seuss. You know, the more that you read, the more things you will know, the more that you learn, the more places you'll go. And, you know, talking about travel, kind of coming back to that idea, you can go anywhere. You can go online with your work. You can go on a page, into a notebook. You can go to Denmark, wherever you want to go. And the important thing is to listen and to enjoy it. And I think Dr. Seuss does just that with his humor.
You know, and now that I think about it, as I go through Knock Knock again, I could see the influence of Baudelaire and Dr. Seuss.
It's there, I admit.
Okay, we're out of time, but before we go, would you like to read a short poem for us for our Poem of the Week, either one from Knock Knock or a new one?
I would love to. I have a poem, Serenka, from my new collection,
oh, awesome.
From Adult Swim, that will be coming out. Serenka, I was at a job interview the other day, and they asked if I wasn't doing what I would like to do, and I told them, be a mermaid. And they looked at me like, what the? And whose stick is she trying to shake anyway? This is a job interview, not a joke. And that's when I said, really, I'm not kidding. It might not show that I have any experience with that on my resume, but some things don't fit on the page. Huh, they laugh. She says she wants to be a sea cow, basically, and drink from shells, like she knows what she's saying. I didn't think I'd get the job after this and think I didn't want it to begin with, but you don't have to not listen when someone tells you stuff. I mean, they were the first ones I told about this, and it makes you think maybe you think too much sometimes and that whatever skills it takes to be a mermaid, I can learn them. You see, I told them, I can swim and dive and decide later about drowning the sailors. Sailors are useful and sometimes cute. And not every mermaid has to do that killer sea singing, and any luring I'd keep to myself. I applied for your job because there's nothing tempting about it, and I'm good at hiding things. Well, they said, we don't need someone who wants to not be part of our team. We're about industry and overtime, not sea cows. Don't call them sea cows, I said. Call a name a name. I would not tattoo Lorelei Rocks on my arm, for example, if I get this job. I would promise to not talk to the fish in the fish tank too much and not wear revealing miniskirts, oh, the fins. Hey, lady, they said, we got a lot of candidates to choose from, and we're just saying no. Discrimination in the workplace, but sounds like you'd rather be a sea monster and stuff. And if you come here, we'd have to deal with complaints and police reports because hiring an aquatic creature these days can be tricky. It sounds like you're talking about giving all this up, they said, to be fusiform. It's not practical to not have feet. About some things they were right, and for sure I'd spend time at work messaging pirate friends and doing my own stuff because sometimes in life you have to go in the direction you have to go, and sometimes that's straight to the sea. Your arm steering waves and onward to estuaries, to Ranka, maid of the waves, sun on your back. This is immense. This is not somewhere else. Hey, I said, look out the window and up. Repeat after me. Rise, rise, rise.
That was Heather Hartley. That was great. I love that poem. I can't wait to read your new book. Heather Hartley, thank you for joining us for Words on a Wire. When your next book, Adult Swim, comes out, we're going to have you on the show again. But meanwhile, Knock Knock is a fantastic book. Good luck.
Daniel, thank you so much in all languages. Merci beaucoup. It's been a pleasure.
I'd like to thank my guest, Heather Hartley, for joining us on Words on a Wire. It was a fantastic conversation. She's a fantastic poet. And, you know, there is a time difference between El Paso and Paris, so we'd like to thank her for staying up late to talk to us and for reading that lovely poem from her new collection, Adult Swim. Next time you're in Paris, check out the events at Shakespeare & Company, which she coordinates, and maybe you'll run into her, and you can have a little bit of coffee on the left bank. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining us for Words on a Wire every week on Sunday at noon. And don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and flaws.